the Dunning-Kruger effect does not just apply to like some stupid person over there, right? It applies to all of us. And we're all ignorant in some domain. And in that domain, we are likely to overestimate our knowledge.
That seems delusional, Louis Theroux once said to a neo-Nazi who believed that since he was white, he was better looking than Denzel Washington. But are you also deluded? Am I deluded? Long-time listeners to the podcast will nod in the affirmative, no doubt, because so many of my episodes are there to point out not only the perils of such delusions and magical thinking that lead us to extreme ideologies and behaviours, but also how we can never be sure of our own cognitive biases and delusions. But can delusions ever be good for us? No doubt the neo-Nazi felt better about himself going through life believing he was better looking than Denzel, although that particular belief will only have entrenched his racist views as he went about finding the public responding to him as though Denzel were the better looking of the two. So that particular delusion is probably no good to him or anyone else. Yet plenty of delusions are good for us in a funny kind of way. And who better to talk us through all of that than a man who has spent a career writing about rationalism, critical thinking, and beliefs in superstitions. American philosopher Stuart Vise serves on the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry, so he's well placed to tackle delusions, and he's also a lovely, interesting man with whom I have a lot of fun on this podcast. Because remember, this is supposed to be enjoyable, isn't it? Or is that a delusion too? Is religious belief a good delusion to hold? What about magical thinking that leads us to gamble and mess up our lives or the lives of others? We'll find out today. Follow Stuart on Stuart Vise on Twitter. Check out his works and life stuff on stuartvise.com and get his new book, which I loved from start to finish, The Uses of Delusion, Why It's Not Always Rational to Be Rational. You can pre-order the hardback edition now. It's out August the 1st, or just the book's out now, so go get it. For the patrons of the podcast, we did a phenomenal bonus episode of 10 to 15 minutes, and he gave some really fascinating answers to my bonus questions. So do check that out or sign up to it. Even if it's just for 1 month, you just, you know, quickly listen to it all, then unsign up on patreon.com/AndrewGold, where you'll get ad-free episodes of this podcast too. But now you're on the edge of delusion with American psychologist, teacher, and author Stuart Vise. What a wonderful book, Stuart. That is just brilliant. Really, really enjoyed it. How are you doing today? Welcome to On the Edge.
I'm doing great, and thank you. What a wonderful introduction. I'm glad you enjoyed the book.
I very, very much enjoyed it. So you start your book with a description of a woman who lost her husband in a car accident. What I want to ask you is, when do we need magical thinking?
Well, I mean, there are lots of, I cover several examples in the book, but this was one, you know, that sort of struck me as being very poignant. But this is a woman that I knew back when I was just starting graduate school, and her husband died very suddenly, unexpectedly, and she was obviously very attached to him. And so she, you know, was a rational person, but she believed that he might come back. And she had this ritual. She worked in the university library, and she used to sit at a window, and there was a very sweet thing that he would walk to the library and pick her up at the end of the day, and they would walk home together. And she told me months later after he died that she still looked down every day to see if he was walking towards the library. And she said one time, you know, I just think he's going to walk through a door someday, you know, and come back. And yeah, it's sad, but at the same time, and obviously it doesn't make sense, but it you know, it's not the kind of thing where any therapist would say, you know, snap out of it. It obviously was something that she needed and was comforting to her in that moment, a very difficult transition, and she evidently moved on with her life after that. But you know, it was a poignant example. It's very much the same thing that happened to Joan Didion. She wrote about it in her book, The Year of Magical Thinking. And so, you know, there's a whole chapter on bereavement that covers a number of these kinds of, you know, prolonged relationships that people claim to have or think they have with people who have died. So I'm a rationalist. I write for Skeptical Inquirer magazine here in the U.S. And so I've been writing about superstition for many years. But I kept coming across these examples where we do things that are not strictly rational. You know, if you're looking at them from a sort of rational choice model point of view, straight economic point of view, and yet they clearly benefit us. And so I began to think more about that and to come up with examples of that are really undeniably irrational but beneficial.
I think one of the things that interested me so much about your book was because this podcast deals so often with magical thinking and stuff, and often to point out the bad sides of it, the scary sides, you know, ideological things. And are you concerned about though, you know, when the delusions take us to bad places as well?
Oh, obviously, yes. I mean, that's where I've spent most of my time in my career, and I try to make make it clear in the book that I'm not throwing out rationality. You know, I'm not suggesting that, you know, and also it's also true that most of the examples of the book, it's not like you're standing at the precipice and you can say, well, I could do the rational thing or I could do the irrational thing. Most of the times, you know, the people who are acting irrationally in this book don't have much choice about it. It's part of their being. And so I'm still a rationalist, very much so, and I do worry about the larger delusions that are unfortunately so popular right now in the culture.
I'm always having these arguments on social media and stuff with people who I think are quite far left wing or quite far right wing, and I always feel like I'm the center ground. But is that a delusion in itself? Because I always think about people who say that they don't have an accent, as an example. I often meet Americans and they'll say, yeah, it's funny, you've got a great accent. And I don't even have an accent. And I'm like, if you heard how I can hear you, you know, it's right, an accent. Right. Is it possible to be devoid of an ideology, for example?
No, I don't think so. Not entirely. I mean, we can try to be aware of it, you know, to the extent that we can. I believe I have an accent, for example. But I do think that we are subjective beings, and we come from our own point of view. It's hard to be completely free of false beliefs that they're just there. But we do have certain ways of trying to parse it and to avoid the pitfall. So I think it's good that you're in the middle. I think that that's probably a smarter place to be. It seems to me that most of the dangerous delusions are on the far left and right at the moment.
It's the best answer then to always go into things thinking, I might be wrong, I might not be sure, because of course then you get accused of being some sort of fence sitter or not caring. That's what I get accused of sometimes. No, it's not that. It's, do you know what I mean?
Yes, I do. I think that's exactly the right attitude. One of the mental exercises that I think is very useful is to ask yourself, what are the best arguments on the other side of the issue? Like you, if you have a point of view, what are the strongest arguments on the other side? And that may take a little bit of research, actually, for some of us, because we may not have come across those best arguments yet. But yes, there is a need to try to look at both sides. And then, of course, sometimes you just say, well, I'm still going to stick with what I've got. Or, you know, in the rare instance, you might be persuaded to the other side. But to not think about it that way, I think, is a mistake. Definitely. It's an aspect of critical thinking.
You speak of, or you write of, useless delusions and harmful delusions. And I think one of the, because I write all my notes like 3 a.m. and I do it on my phone. So I sort of like, I go, okay, and I go to the site, because that's when I'm reading to go to bed.
Yes.
And so a lot of my notes don't make sense, and I just have to make sense of them at the time. But it was a useless delusion, something like flat earth theory, and a harmful one like ratio bias, which is sort of gambling and things like that.
Right. The flat earth, of course, I don't think it's all that harmful, but it's clearly irrational. I mean, it is, I guess that the people who are flat earthers and are public about it, are definitely going to get some ridicule for that. But beyond that, they're probably functioning okay. There seem to be some very high-profile people that are flat earthers at the moment, which is shocking. Yes, ratio bias is a funny thing that involves gambling, where people tend to be influenced by the wrong aspect of the probability, right? For example, if you're given the choice, you get to pick from one of two bowls, and you want to pick a black marble out of the bowl, right? And so one bowl has 10 marbles with just one black ball out of the 10, and another bowl has 100 marbles with 10 black marbles out of the 100. So probability is exactly the same, but they are quite different. The bowls are quite different. And there's a tendency among people to want to go for the big bowl because there's 10, you know, I got 10 winning chances over here, right? I've only got one in this one. And that's fine. That's not irrational. But what, you know, the research has shown in the past is that when you now take one of the black marbles out of the larger bowl, so now there are only 9, right? But still, it's 9, right? It's 9, not 1. And so there are people who will choose, a shocking number of people, who will still choose the larger bowl because there are 9. And so they're being sort of distracted by the larger number of winning chances and not taking into the denominator, obviously, which the probability is now lower in that bowl and so on. So that's clearly a delusion of sorts or an error of some kind and not a good one, right? It probably explains why some people play the lottery when they shouldn't.
Yeah, I was actually thinking about what you'd written, the next day after reading when I was listening to the radio in the car, because they have all these things, which I imagine they have in the US as well, where they say, answer this question or something, like send in a text to us, and then we're going to call the first person who picks up. And if you pick up after 3 rings or something, and that's sort of a sleight of hand because they're tricking you. It's like the game is that you have to pick up within 3 rings. And really the game is you've got to be one out of I think the winnings was something like £30,000, and they were getting like 50p per text. So I thought they have to have at least 60,000 people calling in for it to be worth it. So if you saw a list of all the 60,000 numbers, the chance that someone will pick yours is like astronomical. But because you're thinking about this whole thing of like, oh, they're going to call and I've got to pick up on the rings, I can do that. I can answer a call like that. Because I was almost tempted to call in, and that would have been stupid unless I was the winner.
Exactly. And of course, the investment on your end is small, but they're betting on thousands of people doing it. So yeah, it's, lotteries have been described, and this is, I consider this sort of a lottery. Lotteries have been described as taxes on people who can't do math.
Yeah. Except say that to the ones who won it.
Well, I know. There's always got to be a winner, doesn't there?
I know. I said this to my dad about it being a tax on. I didn't say on stupid people because I'm nice to my dad, and I don't think he's stupid. And I don't mean to imply that all the listeners, because again, statistically, many will do the lottery and many will have won stuff. So good luck to them. One of the delusions that we have, or one of the types of delusion, is sort of more positive thinking about ourselves, positive views of ourselves, the idea that we have more control than we do, and more optimistic about our futures. And is that helpful for us then to have this positive concept of ourselves?
Well, I think in a number of ways it is, and in a couple of ways it's not. It depends on the context, and that's true of a number of the delusions in the book, that they are sometimes good but not always good. And so the optimism bias is, first of all, it seems to be very true, very widespread, and in fact it is probably a component of good mental health to have a sort of overconfident sense of yourself. It is very valuable, I think, in circumstances. For example, if you're, let me start with the bad news. The bad news is that at the beginning of an enterprise, if you're overconfident, especially if there's a big downside, for example, starting a business, or in the worst case scenario, starting a war, right? If you are overconfident about your abilities, at that point, that could, this is the moment where you probably should be coldly rational and pessimistic, and think of all the ways in which it could go wrong at that moment. Of course, if everybody did that, then maybe there would be no businesses at all, that, you know, people would not go into business. But that's the moment where overconfidence could be a problem. Once you're engaged and you're doing the enterprise, then overconfidence, I think, is quite valuable, because it gets you up in the morning and working and doing things. And if you're working in a team, if you're a leader and you're overconfident, that's kind of contagious, and your fellow workers will work hard as well. So I think that it depends on the circumstance. Also, it's true in a number of competitive situations. I talk about tennis in the book, and you know, the idea that if you are overconfident about your ability and you're convinced of it, you're really convinced of it, you're not putting it on, then that is going to be detected by your opponent, and it can only help. So I think that in sort of day-to-day combat, whether it be work or sport, that overconfidence can be quite valuable.
Is that why tennis players often sort of scream and yell? It's a warrior cry.
Yes. Yeah. It depends on the situation. I talk also about tantrums. You know, there are players that have tantrums on the court. McEnroe, exactly, and others like it. And I don't think that's actually very helpful. You know, the commentators always say, like, well, he's psyching himself up. This is how he does it. You know, that it's usually he, and they, you know, they explain it away. But what they're ignoring is the effect on the competitor. Like if I'm playing somebody and they erupt into a tantrum, I'm going to say, "Hey, I'm doing okay." You know, that's a good thing.
Andy Murray as well, guilty of that.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And so I think that some of the better players are the ones that sort of look like cyborgs. You know, they just keep coming at you, and that's tough to deal with from the other side.
God, it really felt, actually, and I know obviously this is my own bias, but watching the tennis over the last sort of decade or so, obviously supporting Andy Murray, him being British, it did feel like there were these three cyborgs in Nadal, Djokovic and Federer, who were just like, nothing fazed them. Whereas Andy Murray felt to me like a very British thing. It's the same in the soccer or the football when we take penalty shootouts, the most tense part, and it was like we always lost to the Germans, who were just these robots. Of course, I'm sure some of that's in my mind, but that's the impression we had of ourselves as like these emotional beings who let ourselves down in those big occasions.
Yeah, maybe John McEnroe got a little of that too. But yes, yeah, I like Andy Murray. I think he's a good player.
Oh yeah, he was great in his when he wasn't injured too badly. Did you see, speaking of like being overconfident about war, did you see that George Bush thing when he came out the other day and one man should never have such power to launch an attack on Iraq. I mean Ukraine.
Unbelievable. I mean, that is the Freudian slip of all time, really. I can't help but think that it was going through his mind. But yeah, that war was a mistake, and I hope that Putin will recognize that this war was a mistake too. But
he doesn't seem the type, Putin, to recognize his mistakes. Is there something in evolutionary psychology in our being so sort of confident about our ideologies and stuff, and why we stick with them so much? Have you given much thought to that?
Well, there's a lot of, I mean, obviously we do a lot of self-protective things. We do like to believe that our ideas are right, that we're smart and so forth. So that does lend itself to pushing aside conflicting information, you know, confirmation bias and so on. It makes you feel, we all feel better if we haven't wasted our time with stupid ideas and if our ideas are valid. So I think that's pretty much built in and part of the system, which is, can be a problem, obviously. You know, when it turns out your ideas are wrong, it's not a good idea to cling to them. But I do think that that's a natural human tendency to be self-protective. It's hard to accept the alternative. And so it's a skill. I mean, if you're a critical thinker, it's obviously a skill that you have to tune up. You need to be able to reject when you're convincingly, proven wrong, you have to be willing to accept it and move on. And but that's hard to do.
It's painful. It almost actually physically hurts, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does. Yeah, I've tried to tune myself. One of the things of being a writer, right, is if you have an editor or if you have readers, you get these, and sometimes the reports are anonymous, which means that they can say whatever they want and not get hurt by it. So you do have to thicken your skin a little bit, and I've tried to learn that skill, but it is hard, especially when you're doing something as close to your core as writing, right? Where these are my words and thoughts, right? And you just don't understand, but it's tough.
I have that with the podcast because the people who can review it on Apple, they are anonymous and you can't reply. So you can't even leave a little message underneath saying, well, hang on, no, you've misunderstood. And it's really, really frustrating. Hey, why did you tell your children, why did you tell your kids that everything takes longer than you think?
Well, I think it does. I mean, that's part of the optimism bias, right? That we set out on a project and we think, oh, this will just take 10 minutes. And before you know it, you're late and it's not happening. So yes, that was one of those annoying dad sayings that my kids probably are sick of. But I think it's mostly true and certainly a protective one. If you assume that things are going to take longer than you imagine they will, then you're probably going to be safe. So,
hey, it's Andrew. If you're enjoying Heretics, there's another podcast I want to recommend to you, especially if climate change, global conflicts, and an upcoming election are making you feel like we're on the brink of disaster. What Could Go Right is hosted by Progress Network founder Zachary Carabel and executive director Emma Varvalukas. On What Could Go Right, the hosts sit down with expert guests to discuss the world's most pressing issues without resorting to pessimism or despair that we hear so often. Instead, they look back at how far society has come and look forward at what it will take to achieve an even brighter future. Is progress on the way? They may not have all the answers, but on What Could Go Right, they're asking the key questions. Tune in to hear interviews with upcoming guests like writer Coleman Hughes, CNN host Fareed Zakaria, and economist Alison Schrager. If you're looking for a weekly dose of optimistic ideas from smart people, join them every Wednesday on What Could Go Right, available wherever you get your podcasts. I've got this great bias that I've recognized in myself where I'll get very excited about a potential job offer or a documentary chance for the BBC or whoever it might be. And then if it doesn't happen, my brain will very quickly think that I never wanted it in the first place. And because actually it'll be better to do it in this other way. And what a relief I didn't get that thing. Do you think that's universal?
I think it's very common. I don't know if it's universal or not, but it's sort of the sour grapes thing. They were probably sour grapes anyway. But it is true that if you think about that sequence you're describing, as it was an exciting possible offer, you probably have a bias to think of all the positive aspects of it, and if you had accepted it and done it, some of those negative things that came to you later might have presented themselves as well. But in the moment of anticipation, you probably have this bias in the other direction. And it's undoubtedly helpful, once it goes away. Again, it helps your ego and your feeling about yourself if you say, well, come to think of it, it would have been a pain in the butt and, probably wouldn't have worked that well. So neither view is realistic entirely, but you can understand the psychology of both.
Yeah, I suppose it's all leading towards this concept of delusion about our own self-worth in a more positive sense. Thinking more positively, it serves, I suppose, as a motivator to get up and do the next thing.
Exactly. If you didn't think you were worthy and if you didn't think that, there are good things ahead for you, then it would be hard to get out of bed. We've said this a couple of times, but there is good research that suggests that the normal psychology for a non-depressed person is to be overconfident. There's this classic study where people were asked to press a button to try to turn on a light, and it was sort of was a funky light that sometimes you pressed and it didn't go on, other times it would go on when you hadn't pressed, and so forth. And so when it was all over, people were asked, how much control did you have over the light, you know? And normal, non-depressed people said they had a lot of control over the light, but they overestimated how much they had. And whereas people who were mildly depressed had a very accurate, you know, estimate of how much control they had over the light. So the subtitle of the article was something like "Sadder but Wiser," because, you know, these depressed people had a realistic view, whereas typical non-depressed have an overly rosy view. And so that's why I say this optimism bias is undoubtedly part of good mental health and a motivational tool.
But also could take you away from reality a little bit. Do you think it has anything to do with, I don't know, levels of serotonin in the brain if you're depressed and something isn't functioning to allow you to delude yourself in a way that it does with non-depressed people?
I have no idea. I mean, obviously serotonin is involved in treatment of depression, but what goes on in the brain there is kind of a mystery to me. But what's clear from outside the brain and from what we see of people is that it's extremely common to be overconfident among happy, well-adjusted people. So.
And what about the Dunning-Kruger effect?
So Dunning-Kruger effect is where you don't know something about a subject, but you think you do. And it's apparently quite common, and it has been challenged recently. But my view of the research is that it still holds up as a principle. So it's sort of like it's one thing to not know, to be ignorant of something, right? Like you think that I said that I know a lot about medicine, for example, which I don't. But I believed I did, right? So that the one problem there is that, first of all, I don't know anything about medicine. That's one problem. But the other thing is that I'm not aware of my ignorance. And so that's the Dunning-Kruger effect, that people who actually don't know much about a subject are often unaware of it. And so it's a double whammy in a sense, a double problem. And it's common. One of the studies my most favorite study on this topic is one where there were people in who knew very little about autism and the causes of autism, right? But they actually believed they knew more than doctors knew, right? Their knowledge was very, very low, right? And they thought they knew more than doctors did. And whereas people who were quite knowledgeable, according to this test that was taken, an objective test, actually slightly underestimated their ability. And so ignorance has real problems. It's bad enough to be ignorant. It's quite another thing to be unaware of it.
And autism is an interesting example, because I guess that exact ignorance led people around the world to believe that vaccines caused autism.
Exactly. And in fact, the people who were the most ignorant about it were more likely to endorse the idea that celebrities should be our guide as to what to do about vaccines and so forth, as opposed to medical experts, So
imagine saying that you're getting asked by psychologists and things to do a survey, like, who do you trust more, doctors or celebrities? And you're thinking Brad Pitt knows a lot about this stuff. It's just so bizarre.
It's crazy. So anyway, but it's a problem. The thing that I will say this, and I've written about Dunning-Kruger separately from this, one of the things that David Dunning, who's one of the authors, points out all the time is that the Dunning-Kruger effect does not just apply to like some stupid person over there, right? It applies to all of us. And we're all ignorant in some domain. And in that domain, we are likely to overestimate our knowledge. So it's both troubling and to some extent humbling concept.
One, I think I find that a lot in languages. And I know people, I mentioned my that I speak a few languages on pretty much so many episodes that people have even written in saying it's a drinking game now, that when I mention that I speak some languages to show off about it, somebody has to have a drink. But that is the place where more than any other I've really noticed it, because you go somewhere like France and you speak French or whatever, and sometimes they don't speak any English. They'll only speak like two or three words, but they'll be so sure that their slight knowledge of English outdoes my French, even though I've studied in French and lived in French and worked in French, that every time I speak French to them, they'll come back in English and go, yes, but
right,
or something. And I just think, if you knew how much goes into actually, you know, it's so frustrating to me. I know I sound arrogant about it, but it's so frustrating to me. I put so much time. There were so many words. There's so much with syntax and different things you've got to get to grips with. And that's probably a Dunning-Kruger thing, isn't it?
No, I'm sure it is. I know the feeling. I've had that happen to me too. I mean, I speak very little French, but it is frustrating to go out into, you know, another language and then have them come back in yours. It's like a slap in the face.
Yeah,
but
it's really rude.
Maybe it is. So
especially because if you do speak English, they're also offended. They're like, you've come to France, and then I'm not just having to go French people, by the way. This is universal. But you come to France and you speak in English, but then if you speak French, they're like, oh, a challenge, hey? And then they'll come back to you in English. So if you don't speak much French, try and say a sentence, then they will go back to English. I think that's the way to do it. One thing, speaking of like stereotyping cultures and things, which I like to do, whenever I've been to the States, very smiley people in customer service in particular, and quite smiley in the UK as well, probably. I lived in Germany for a few years, not the case at all. It's just not a thing that's done. And you write about the sort of the cognitive dissonance from a lack of authenticity that comes from having to smile in service jobs. What's that about?
Yeah, it's apparently, I mean, if you think about the people that we encounter out in the world when we go out there now, you know, they are required as part of the job to be kind and smart and smile and so forth. And of course, if you think about the airlines lately, it's, you know, they have a real challenge at the moment because people are behaving very badly, or were during the time when masks were required and so forth. But that actually turns out that inauthenticity, they're sort of putting on a smile, is referred to as emotional labor. It is a problem for them. I bring this up in the context of you know, being able to, you know, own your emotions and feel confident and believe your own hype, as opposed to these circumstances where people have to put it on. And in those circumstances, it can be a problem. It can be difficult. What they look for, the interesting thing is that the people who are best adjusted at this, like airline, hostesses and so forth, they give a certain amount to the customer initially, in terms of warmth and so forth, but they don't go beyond that unless it's reciprocated. And if the customer, you know, reciprocates, then they can let their guard down a little bit and so forth. But in order to protect themselves to some degree, they put on a minimal level of cordiality and you know, warmth, that they then extend further if it's reciprocated by the customer. And that apparently those people do better. They have a better adjustment and are less stressed out by their job. So it's an interesting thing.
So rather than like putting it on too much from the beginning, just giving a bit of cordiality and then sort of, and just waiting to see if it's necessary to continue.
Exactly. And see whether it's safe to continue, in a sense. Yeah.
That's really interesting. Because I think about, I mean, I think I do that. I think in this job, I don't think it's necessarily conscious so much. It sort of comes out. Sometimes I do these live streams where I'm interviewing people for 4 hours straight, and I come out of that more tired emotionally than if I could run a marathon or something, because I'm smiling, I'm engaging in conversation, I'm doing all this stuff. It takes energy.
It does. It definitely does. It's work. You know, it is. It's anything that's not, you know, second nature to you, and that you're consciously, you're having to sort of, you know, address with concentration, it's going to wear you out. And So I have great sympathy for the people who have to work with the public in that regard. I'm glad that I can just throw words out and people can, I don't know what they respond, how they respond to them or not, but.
Yeah. Awfully, terribly. No, we love your work.
It's apparently, it's good at putting you to sleep at night and when you're reading it.
I always read at night. It's the best thing because I didn't used to sleep well. And I studied English literature at university, so loads of books. And I had a couple of years afterwards where I was like, you know what? I don't want to ever read a book again in my life, right? And I didn't sleep well. Yeah. And a couple of years later, I got back into it again. I got a Kindle, so I didn't have to have a light on that annoyed my girlfriend or anything while I'm trying to sleep. So it's just because it's a little screen that's slightly lit up.
Yeah.
And now it's just like I never, ever, if I go to sleep and I think, oh, I can't find my Kindle, I'll have like a panic attack now because I've got it. It's so good at getting into a sleepy mood.
Yeah, yeah. It settles you. It's good. It's great.
Yeah, that's the thing. But yeah, just your book was so interesting that I lost sleep. No, it's
I'm sorry about that.
Yeah. That's yeah, okay. You should be. No matter even if it is when it is really interesting like yours, I mean it just takes my mind away from like the worries of the day and that stuff, and I'm just in the book and then I'm asleep and it's great. But you talk about code switching, which is a similar thing and to what we were just saying, I suppose, and you would change your accent a little bit at times.
Yeah, this is one example that I had from my youth that was somewhat similar to the airline host person. But I was working in a factory. And it was actually, I really enjoyed the job. It was quite different from anything I had ever done. And I was a summer job in the town that I lived in Illinois. And it was a factory for building stadium bleachers, the bleachers that might be in a field house inside, you know, the kind that collapse and then come out. And it was a lot of metal. It was a lot of cutting and drilling and just really very different things than I had done, welding. And the people who worked there full time and were not summer hires like me were from the country. And even though, you know, we were not living that far apart, we were working at the same place, they were relatively uneducated and had different accents than me. I hadn't even started really at university that much, but apparently I spoke differently than they did. And I felt uncomfortable. You know, it was like, I want to be a part of this group. I want to feel comfortable with them. And so I slowly adapted some of their speech patterns and a little bit of their accent. No one said anything about it. No one, you know, said, hey, what are you, now you're talking differently or anything like that. But my sense was, and of course it's not a true experiment, I don't know, but my sense was that I fit in a little bit better. I felt as though I fit in with them. And then at home, I would go home and speak the normal way. So it didn't stick or anything. We do that. I think that the different environments we're in, we present ourselves in different ways. I have an example also in the book of people in work situations who are sometimes very nice to people of their own stature, but then treat people below their stature very rudely. So we are different people in different environments and can be very easily.
Yeah, I think I've told this story before, but that really stuck with me when I read that, because I did the same thing when I was like, I must have been about 10 years old, and I used to go to football, soccer games at Tottenham Stadium with my dad, and then my brother started coming along, and then, so we couldn't get seats all together, so my dad and brother sat in one place, and my dad walked me along, you know, 15 seats away, and sort of said to the other fans, this is Andrew, he's going to be sitting here now, and I was a little kid. And we're so aware of class and accents in the UK, I think more than in some other places. It's such a big part of our like social fabric. And I was aware of being sort of middle class or whatever, and football and soccer at the time was a working class man's game, really. Less and less so now because of the money involved in TV and stuff like that, and the money to go to the games. And I remember my dad left me there, and I was sort of looking up at all these people around me, and he went off, and I just affected this really working. I was like, all right, lads, how's it going? Yeah, yeah, a bit of a game today, innit? All right, we win. And it created a problem for me because it meant whenever my dad came over, like at half time, to come and say hello or whatever, I couldn't speak in front of him. And after a few years, I began to realize that my only way out of it was for every season, every year, to gradually lose some of those sort of the working class inflections and things. It took about 10 years of gradually doing it so that nobody noticed. And I think I got away with it.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah, that's a very good example. It's exactly the same phenomenon. But you probably felt better doing it, right? Surrounded by these other people.
Sure.
I am aware of the fact that accents, we have accents here too, obviously, you know, Southern and Northern and so forth, but it's probably not as quite as dramatic as you know, the posh accent versus the, you know, working class is quite different over there. So
yeah, it's a real thing. It's a real thing. I think I tried to hide it for years, and then I just went, you know what, what's the, you got to live your life. Yeah. You got to be who you are. I remember asking my dad at one point, you know, Dad, are we posh? It was this big thing on my mind when I was about 16. And he just said, well, you are, but I'm not. Very strange.
That's great. You know. Yeah.
Tell me about some other bad kinds of overconfidence. You mentioned war, I suppose, mortgages, loans, student loans.
Yeah. I don't know what the system is over there, but and having taught at an expensive liberal arts college for much of my career, I'm very aware of this. And I also wrote a book about debt, personal debt, earlier, but called Going Broke. But people, you know, part of it is that university education, for some people, not everyone, obviously, it has been put on a pedestal, and the importance of getting to the very best possible school you can has been really promoted by parents and others. And so you have a situation where you have a person who is literally 18, and they can't, you know, they can't drink a beer legally in the U.S. They can't do a lot of things, but they make one of the biggest financial decisions of their lives by signing on to enormous amounts of debt. And there are, I come across a number of examples of people who just assumed that all things would work out well. For example, in that other book, there's a case of a woman who had always been a very good student. She went to law school, took out loans to go to law school, and she came up across a course that she just could not pass. And it had never happened to her before. She just could not. She even dropped out of that school and went to a different law school and still could not pass the same, whatever the course, the topic was at that second school. She ended up with something like, you know, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 in debt and no degree for it, right? She had the debt, she'd paid for it, but she, you know, so those are the situations. I mean, some of them are unforeseeable and that may be rare, but what we don't hear about much here in the US, at least, is the regret. There, if you look around and ask people, they'll say, many of them will say, I wish I hadn't taken out those loans, you know, because they drag on forever. And, but at the time, you're not thinking about that. You're not, you know, you are thinking about the shiny degree and going to college and the fun you're going to have there. And so it's a problem.
There are intangible parts, aren't there, to going to university, because it is also about, you know, often if you live in the university, you know, learning to cook and stuff and meeting different kinds of people. So there's that as well. But I think also you were saying that a lot of people do better off in their careers now without going to university. Is that the stats at the moment?
Well, the situation is this, that it's with respect to the debt itself. So, and this is an interesting phenomenon. So in the past, it was the case that they track people and they're sort of acquiring the life's goals, like getting married, buying a car, buying a house, right, as sort of the adulthood milestones. And it used to be the case for many years that people with college debt actually hit those markers sooner. Why? The assumption being because they had a college degree and they were actually earning enough to overtake their debts and to do well. That is reversed now in the U.S., that people who don't have college debt are hitting those markers much sooner in terms of buying homes, getting married, having kids, all of those things. And which shows, I think, that the amount of drag that the debt, it's now enormous amounts. You know, it's not uncommon to have people with $100,000 or more in debt just for a basic bachelor's degree. And so the amount of drag that produces, shuts off a lot of decisions they have. And it's a sad situation. And I have to say, as much as I like Bernie Sanders, the idea of just canceling the debt is, to my mind, ridiculous. I mean, I'm very sympathetic to all the politicians that are saying that, but it's a stupid idea because, like, next week some other kid is going to sign on to more debt. You know, you haven't fixed the system. It's easy to just say cancel debt, right? But you haven't changed anything about the system that creates the debt.
Virtue signaling, a little bit.
Exactly. Definitely. No, it's very easy. It's very easy to say that, and not so easy to fix the system.
Yeah, we've got a system in the UK that, because I think some of our systems are a little bit more socialist a bit than in the US, the healthcare, for example. Most things are the same, but there's the healthcare you get. And then the student loans, you don't have to start paying them back until you're earning over a certain amount, which is usually, you know, I don't know, $25,000 it would be, or £20,000 or something like that. I don't have the updated figures. Is that maybe a better solution, so you're not sort of forced into very quickly having to pay back any amount?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent system. I mean, one of the problems with the current system here, I mean, think about it, a lot of the jobs that people would want, the entry-level jobs are either, sometimes they're no pay, they're internships, or they are very low pay. And so if you suddenly, as soon as you graduate, which is the case here in the U.S., pretty much as soon as you graduate, you have to start making these payments. And if you don't, you know, the interest accrues anyway, gets more and more, right? So you know, that means you can't take that job. You have to make a different job. You know, I know it's sort of standard issue now that law students, for example, who might go to law school for very admirable reasons. They want to do, you know, some public defense or some, you know, cause. They graduate with so much debt that they're forced to work for a big firm, a Wall Street or some kind of expensive firm just to pay off the debt. And then maybe after that, they can think about doing the thing that they originally wanted to do. So yeah, I think it's a much better system, as you describe it.
We should tell Bernie that.
Yes. Yeah.
It is. It did take the pressure off. And I left university, and there's still that pressure, of course, that everyone has at 21, 22 years old. And you're like, I've got to get a job, otherwise I'm unemployable. And, you know, but I went off to Argentina, and I lived in Colombia for some time as well, and lived there. And I worked basically on minimum wage from getting, and because I didn't have that debt hanging over my head, I was able to do that. And I think what you're saying is a really good point, because we have the same problem in the UK, where these jobs that are typically associated with perhaps highbrow people who study the arts and the humanities and stuff. So I'm thinking about book publishing, podcast productions, the same, where people are always complaining, oh, you know, why is it sort of white middle class people dominating these industries? And a lot of that is because, you know, you don't make any money. They're not well paid at all. There's the prestige, isn't it? The social prestige. There's no finance, especially if you've got a debt hanging over your head. How can you get into those kinds of industries?
And so if you can't take those cheap jobs and get the experience and then maybe work up to a paying job, you're in trouble. And that's cut off by anybody who has substantial debt, that whole path. So it makes sense in a horrible sort of way.
Yeah. Whereas maybe somebody who didn't go to university, but maybe could have even left high school early, started quite low down at a company. I've seen some people do that. The Sun newspaper I used to work at, some people who started when they were 16, maybe part time, and they climbed the ropes. So by the time somebody came out of university with huge debt, they were already past that place. So there is, I guess, an argument for that.
There is, yeah, sadly.
What do you think about, I mean, what, at one point you write of being buoyed by the knowledge that you're a great writer, and no one will tell you otherwise. I'm going back to the delusions, yes, of confidence and stuff. One thing I was wondering when I read that was about something you hear more and more about, which is imposter syndrome. And I saw somebody saying that she had imposter syndrome. It was a British celebrity, and she was on the front page of a newspaper, and she was just like all like, like, you know, and looked, people listening won't know what I just did, but I was sort of, I suppose I was posing. And I just thought, am I being a bit hard here, a bit harsh? But I'm a bit skeptical of, I think we like to believe we have imposter syndrome, but I think what you were saying is that most of us are actually overconfident.
Yeah, most of us are overconfident. Imposter syndrome, if you hear about it from somebody else, may have a certain virtue signaling, you know, trying to put off a feeling of gratitude and, you know, so forth. But I'm sure it's real for some people. I do give an example in the book of my own case where it was not so much imposter syndrome as defensive pessimism. You know, the idea being that when I first was hired at a tenure track college, and I was up for tenure, and I had to work very hard, and it wasn't a sure thing. And if you don't get tenure, you actually lose your job. You have to go, you have to leave the place. And so I was also from sort of I was a relatively middle class kid. I went to public universities, which apparently means something different over there than it does here. But nonetheless, the idea was that, I was now at a very wealthy private school, where with the students who had often gone to boarding schools and so on, and my colleagues were Harvard and Yale graduates, and I was thinking, don't get used to this place. You may have to leave. You really like it here, but that was sort of a unrealistic pessimism. But I couldn't think of any other way to do it. I knew that I would be so crushed if I didn't get tenure that it would be better if I hadn't sort of gotten used to being here. And that's called defensive pessimism. And it's also a delusion of sorts, and it can have value in some situations. I found it sort of a double-edged sword. I think it did help me get through, and it probably and I did work hard, and I did get tenure, thankfully. But the downside of it was that I couldn't shake it very quickly, as you probably read in the book. Like, as soon as I got tenure, I couldn't really let myself now fully embrace the place right away. It was like it took some time to say, oh, yes, now you really do belong here, and you have earned it, and you're just as good as anyone else. And so so there's a downside to it. But defensive pessimism can be useful in certain circumstances. And I talk about, for example, an impending plague, for example, that if you're defensively pessimistic as the virus is coming to town, you're probably going to take protective action that will, benefit you. Whereas if you're optimistic in that situation, you could get into trouble.
Do you think that plays a role at the beginning of relationships, romantic relationships? There's a sort of, you don't want to get hurt, and I think a lot of people play that hard to get stuff. Is there a bit of defensive pessimism in there?
I'm sure there is for some, yeah. I'm sure that the worry that, like, this is too good to be true, I don't want to get used to this because it may just be a passing thing. There's a lot of potential hurt involved in those situations, and so allowing yourself to fully embrace the idea can be dangerous. But not everybody does it that way. Some people are just fools for love and will go right in and then get their hearts broken afterwards.
Oh, God. Why, speaking of love and stuff, why do you think marriage tends to get worse in terms of sort of well-being and happiness when you have children, even worse when they're teenagers, and then better after the teens leave home? Because I've always had a feeling when I've seen couples like, oh, they must get a bit depressed after the kids leave. But is that not true?
Well, I think these are overall trends, and apparently they're not consistent across all countries. Much of the data that has been provided, and I think that has to do, by the way, with the childcare and other things that are different across countries. But in the U.S. at least, the data does suggest that the arrival of children, as much as it may be love, an admired thing and something that everybody wants to do, or many people want to do, that it does tend to lower marital satisfaction. and that it you know gets better after they leave the nest. So I mean, it's I don't know if you've gone through it or not, but I am old enough that I have gone through it. The arrival of kids, as much as it is a life changing and wonderful experience, does tend to increase the stress involved in a marriage. My marriage actually did not survive. Whether that had to do with the kids or not is another thing. But the time and effort and work involved in doing it well is an added thing. So, anyway,
was that also down to your refusal to believe in soulmates?
yes, that may be part of it. There's a story in the book about the idea that a girlfriend at the time claimed that she thought we were soulmates and wanted me to believe it too. And I made the rash statement that, you know, just doing the math, the millions of people in the world, there might have been any number of other people that we could have met that we would like just as much. She did not want to hear that. And it was a very unromantic thing to say, apparently. But yeah, I mean, lovers want to hear more than just, you know, I love you and I'm doing my best, right? They want to hear something more than that. And I talk about that quite a bit in the book, that there is an unrealistic aspect to love relationships, but some of that is apparently very beneficial.
We've got about 7 minutes left, and one thing I'm always really fascinated about, so I want to move on to that, is determinism versus free will. Could you just explain briefly what that really means, just to lay people or people who have not come across those concepts?
Yeah, I have a section in the book at the end. I leave it to the end because it's the big one, in which I suggest that our sense of conscious will, that we decide to do things, is an illusion. It's not a popular view, but it's not, I'm not the only one. And I think that it makes sense in a number of ways. First of all, I do think that it's a useful delusion. It is a delusion that has many benefits. But it's a delusion in the sense that there's a lot of evidence that we feel like we do make things happen when we don't. And we also have the opposite view, right? We have the feeling that we're not making something happen. Like, for example, if you're playing with an Ouija board, right? I'm not moving it. You must be moving it. No, I'm not moving it. And so that it is easy. And there's this guy, Dan Wegner, did a number of experiments, and we showed how he could separate those things out. He could fool people into believing they had made something happen when they hadn't, and the opposite. And so, you know, our subjective sense is really the best evidence we have, right? I really do feel like I'm making decisions, I'm moving this hand, you know, and so on. But it's obvious that it can be fooled. We can be fooled, and so that's part of it. The other thing that to me doesn't make sense logically, because we have no problem with, you know, the entire universe, planets, galaxies, and so forth, thinking of those as just sort of billiard balls out there doing their thing. They're not deciding to do what they do. They're just doing it, right? And even on Earth, much of what we encounter, except for us and maybe a couple of other species, we have no problem with thinking that they are just, you know, mechanistically doing what they're doing. So we have to carve out some special rule for us if it's true that we have free will. And to me, it's hard not to believe that we just sort of believe it. You know, we have this illusion and we believe it, and it's not really different from billiard balls and nature.
I suppose we have some. Well, I'll boil that down to its most layperson-y thing that, so I guess what you're saying is the universe, billiard balls, and we're made up of that same stuff, atoms bumping around and stuff. And so when you think you're thinking something, it's actually just things bumping around. When you think you've decided to walk, it's not you've made a decision, the brain has done it. And that has all sorts of ramifications for sort of morality and who you punish and don't punish. But it's also like, it's not just humans, because it's I mean, I guess we, to an extent, we think maybe dogs have some of it, but a bit less free will than us. And then cats even less. And then we go down to insects where we'd say, oh, they don't really have, they really are sort of robots and stuff, right?
Right, right. Yeah, no, I think that's what I say. You know, somewhere between insects and us, there's a line. And we have special rules for those species. And the rest of the universe, which is very large, right? There are no special rules. It all obeys the laws of physics and chemistry. So that's the part that is. And the other thing is that there's other research in experimental philosophy that shows that the when we see an action that someone takes, right, we judge how free they were, whether they had a choice or not, largely on how we feel towards them. If we want to punish that action, we are much more likely to say you had a choice, you could have done differently. Whereas if it's a neutral action, then we're more willing to accept that there was less choice involved. And so it's very difficult for us as humans, since we are social beasts and we want to control each other and get along and have our systems work. It's very hard for us to be objective in any judgment of certainly other people's actions. And so that obviously applies to ourselves as well. You know, when you do something wrong, right, suddenly all the external factors that, you know, well, I had a cold and I was tired and he was making this noise. You know, all these external factors suddenly come to the fore when we do something wrong that we, you know. If, on the other hand, we do something right, it's like, yeah, I'm a wonderful person. You know, you take full credit. And so it's very hard for us in these situations to really have an objective view. And it, to me, that also weakens the argument that we have free will.
I suppose, it would be like sports people, or people who are really good. We often say it's down to their genetics to an extent. And we're more willing to accept that. But then, yeah, somebody killed someone. And I suppose, what do you do then? Because to an extent, we're all sort of, are we actors gracing a stage? We're just performing our lines without knowing necessarily what those lines are or being conscious of them. We're just sort of fulfilling these roles, but we are also punishing people for just all they're doing. You know, what, somebody's gone and murdered a baby. That's the most horrible thing I can think of. They're on trial and we go, you piece of whatever, you're a real piece of work and we're going to put you in prison. And I suppose there is an argument of like, well, apart from deterrent, and I suppose we have to, you know, they are what they are. What can they do?
Well, I mean, there are, I mean, obviously the one of the things that makes it, you know, when if that person has an awareness that they killed the kid, right, at least it wasn't an alien that came in and did it, that their body was the one involved in doing it, then that allows punishment to have an effect, right? In other words, we punish those people so that when they get into that situation again, or when someone observes this punishment and they think about killing someone or whatever, that perhaps that memory that, you know, will affect their behavior. So, I mean, the social nature of our species, you know, we're a highly social species. We can't live at birth without someone else feeding us and taking care of us. That requires the ability to affect the group and to control behavior of the group and so forth. So I think this is why I think it's a useful delusion, because the person who feels like they took an action then is eligible for punishment for it, and that feeling will be part of, you know, what they take away from it. I did this thing and now the group has punished me. And so I think we've evolved this for a good reason, that we've evolved this illusion so that the group can have its influence on us.
Glad that you were determined to do this thing, which is the podcast. You've been on the edge. Thank you very much, Stuart Vise.
It's my pleasure, Andrew.
Thank you, Stuart, for your enlightening presence on this here podcast. I had a blast talking delusions with you, and unless I'm deluded, I believe you did too. Everyone, support Stuart's work by pre-ordering the hardback edition of Uses of Delusion, Why It's Not Always Rational to Be Rational, or just get the paperback write-up version or Kindle. It's everywhere and it's a really great read. People are loving it. And that it also gives insights into Stuart's personal life as well. He talks about ex-girlfriends and things. So it's not a purely academic piece. It's quite fun and interesting to read, as well as giving us all these academic insights. It's a great one. Follow him on Stuart Vise on Twitter and check out stuartvise.com to learn more about the man himself. We did a phenomenal bonus episode that you can listen to by signing up on patreon.com/andrewgold. Coming up on the podcast are ex-Scientologist and critical thinker John Atack and conspiracy theory debunker Mike Rothschild. So those will be fascinating. I've actually already done them and I can tell you they are really, really good. And I hope you stick around. Enjoy summer wherever you are in the Northern Hemisphere. Enjoy winter if you're in the South. Whatever you're doing, just enjoy it. Take a moment to take in a deep breath. Because sometimes I fail to do that. I'm just talking. I don't leave a gap on this intro or outro. Take a deep breath and just be. And I'll see you in a few days.